Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Come on, show me the magic.
Can I take you out to the pictures?
Well, I hope you'll come and see me in the movies.
What a scene
of your Hollywood song.
Hello, and welcome to the Beatles Films Podcast. I'm Matt Looker.
I'm Ed Williamson.
We're both professional film writers and Fab Four fans, and each week we discuss a different movie about, starring, or inspired by the Beatles. This week, that film is the 2021 documentary, The Beatles and India, an exploration of the Beatles' relationship with the music and spiritual philosophy of India, and how, in turn, the country inspired the group to explore new creative territory and ultimately bridge the gap between two vastly different world cultures. And I guess I wanted to talk about... I thought the documentary was really effective, and I think it's a really good example of... I mean, we've covered a lot of documentaries in this podcast already... I think this is an example of a documentary that is done very well and is very effective. I think part of the reason for that is, and it was something that I was quite surprised by, which is that the film itself explores India's relationship with the Beatles as much as it explores the Beatles' relationship with India, which is, I think, what you'd assume going into it. This is a film about the Beatles and their time in India, but it's really not. It sets up a really, I think, interesting amount of context for India's relationship with the Beatles, how the Beatles resonated with Indian audiences before their visit to Rishikesh. Mm-hmm. And obviously then I think it does a good job of exploring why the Beatles became so interested in the culture while they were there, and how that must have, or how that obviously ultimately did, influence them going forward, even after they left. But I was saying, I was quite surprised that I think sometimes these documentaries, they try to very specifically explore what the Beatles were up to at that particular time, but this felt like it was much more about the wider context and relationship between the two. Basically, this was a film that was about the Beatles and India, which is what it's called.
Clever title.
I know, right? Yeah. Did you think that? Did you find that? I was surprised by it, that's all. Because it's not normally how these documentaries are. They're normally very much focused on the group itself. But actually, I was pleasantly surprised that it was more interested in the context.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I was surprised by that approach as well. It's very easy to go into Beatles documentaries thinking, okay, well, hopefully I might see a little bit of new footage, or I might hear an anecdote that I haven't heard before. But actually, this is quite apart from most Beatles documentaries, and that it's not particularly concerned with anecdotes. You know, there are a few in there, but there's very little of, I was there at the time, and here's an interesting thing of like when we went to a restaurant and George said this funny thing, or whatever, you know. There are like Indian people who they met in their sort of various visits there who have a couple of stories to tell. But actually, it is talking much more broadly about India's relationship with the Beatles, as you say. There's lots of musicians in there who are much younger, some who are older, you know, who talk about the Beatles' influence on them. Now, every low-rent Beatles documentary has sort of old rockers in it saying, oh, yeah, they're a brilliant band. They influenced us a lot. Thanks for taking part, you know, like, and which is, you know, fine, but you don't learn anything from it. But actually, the fact of we're, as I'm sure most Westerners are to one degree or another, guilty of framing the way we think about things culturally entirely in Western terms. Mm-hmm. And I suppose you and I probably think mainly about how the Beatles influenced the West, the UK, then went over and conquered America and then toured, you know, the touring they did, you know, sort of mainly around Europe and then sort of went off to Australia and places like that. But broadly speaking, just sort of European or sort of English speaking countries, that kind of thing. And I suppose maybe India is a thing that sort of crops up in that narrative. Like 1968, they went to Rishikesh, they wrote loads of the White Album, then they came back. India done, you know? But the nice thing about this is the way it makes clear that the influence they had on that country was being felt like before they visited, you know, and carried on the whole time. It's just really nice to hear that other perspective.
The film starts with a really nice montage, and this is the thing that brought it home to me straight away. The film does a really good job of setting up that context, because we see cheesy shots of like married couple listening to the wireless, but also then immediately cutting to what is clearly like an Indian Beatles tribute band playing, and the crowd going wild for it, you know. But you just wouldn't have thought that was the case. I guess, you know, like you say, we're guilty of assuming that their influence extended only to the Western parts of the world, but as it was, and as this documentary tells us, musicians at the time, particularly musicians at the time, were discovering that music for the first time, and it was having a massive, massive influence on them. Yeah. And actually, what's also really nice is that later on, once the documentary has dealt with the narrative of Rishikesh, then there are other musicians who talk to camera and say that the songs that they wrote on the White Album, knowing that they were written in India, means so much more to them personally.
Yeah.
And this idea of, and there's a it's a songwriting duo who have a very short amount of screen time right towards the end, who are probably the same age as us, probably a bit younger.
I think they're quite a lot younger, to be
honest. Well, they did say growing up in the 80s and 90s.
Oh, okay.
So I thought that's us.
Yeah.
I mean, it's me.
I did get older in the 80s and 90s. It's true.
It's just how time works.
Yeah.
But them saying that they, you know, that their gateway into the Beatles was the White Album and Discover, you know, I think the film does a really good job of tying the influence, even if we can't hear it in the songs, or even if it doesn't register with us now because we're so used to the songs now. But this idea that the songs that they wrote while in India might have this sort of otherworldness to them, partly inspired by the, you know, guitar techniques they learned at the time that made their way into the songs and the subject matter and stuff, but this idea that it's identifiably related to the country they wrote them in because that inspiration is clear in the recordings.
Yeah,
that was quite interesting.
Yeah, it must be nice, I think, sort of culturally to feel that that sort of personal connection. You know, it's quite satisfying when you're a fan of something, for even a fan of a thing that happened years and years ago before you were born. To feel these little personal connections, you know. I saw when we went to, I forget which museum in Liverpool, it's either the Beatles Story or the one on Matthew Street. But there's a picture in one of them of the Beatles backstage at a gig in Exeter. So Exeter is the city I grew up in, and that gig would have been at the old AB Cinema, which had been converted. I think it's now a Waterstones, you know, and I've bought books in that Waterstones.
Wow.
Several times, you know.
You bought books where John Lennon once stood.
Exactly, wow. Exactly. So, you know, in a way I was there.
What books did you have bought?
books about John Lennon. I almost certainly bought The Lives of John Lennon, the widely discredited The Lives of John Lennon by Albert Goldman in that instance. Thinking about it now, yeah, that's probably what happened. But it is nice. So like that picture I really like. And actually I'd quite like to get a copy of it actually. Because it's years before I was born. But it's nice just to feel that little connection.
Yeah, definitely. With them. Yeah.
And I get that. It must be lovely to be an Indian and a Beatles fan and just to have that little connection of that, you know, they wrote all these songs here and they were, and you could quite rightly say there are so many Beatles songs that wouldn't exist or would exist in a completely different form if it wasn't for their experience in India.
Yes, agreed. And I think what's nice about that is that it opens up this idea of Indian influence to exist beyond the obvious examples of like the sitar being used in songs and like Within Without You and
yeah.
stuff. So it proves, I think, or it makes a very good case for the fact that Indian influence extends far beyond those handful of songs that we think about when we think about when George discovered a sitar. You mentioned earlier before about we obviously watch a lot of, well, I think the phrase used was low rent documentaries, where we would go into it thinking, well, he's hoping that there's some footage that I haven't seen before. Did you find much of that in this?
Yeah, I can never be quite sure with the Rishikesh footage because it's sort of home movie footage. There's stuff I certainly was not familiar with. Documentary also does a really good job of, they've gone to the ashram contemporary times, gone to the ashram as it is now. And it's sort of disused and overgrown, which it's been cleared out quite a lot, but it's still in pretty run-down state of disrepair. But they do a good job of, there's points where they superimpose bits of like the Beatles walking in a place in 1968,
yeah,
superimposing how it looks now. That's like quite effectively done.
It's really good, isn't it? I like that effect, as in you've got the because the camera's moving as well. I thought it was quite interesting thing. So you've got the camera panning around a scene. There's a great one, I think, of George on like a stone sort of walkway, almost like a plinth. I think. And the camera's moving, panning around that shot, and then that image appears, and you can tell that that's where he was when that picture was taken.
Yeah.
The frames of the image is what fades away, and what you're left with is George, and just a bit of the background. But as the camera moves around, the background absolutely syncs up, and it's like even the tree looks like it's in the same position.
Yeah.
As that camera moves around, and there's a few things like that. It's like that's a really nice, neat touch that you've done there to really sort of bridge the gap between the two time periods.
Yeah, and it's good looking footage as well that they've got from '68. It's obviously the bits they've used has obviously been touched up and restored, and it looks great. And it just reminded me of that bit in Get Back where they're all in Savile Row, and is it Paul comes in one day and says, oh, we're watching these home movies from India, which is really funny when you think about, because they were there what, just under a year ago, I suppose.
No, yeah, so true, isn't it?
And he's like,
I just dusted off a box that was in the loft, like,
it's like, oh, you remember that holiday we took? I've just been down to Boots and got the film developed. It looks great, you know. And and then we see a bit of that footage, And it makes me think that maybe that's a candidate for what Peter Jackson's doing next, taking that footage and touching that up a bit.
I agree with you. That would be interesting. I do think we're in danger of always saying maybe that's the thing that Peter Jackson is doing next. Like, they should never have made that announcement that he's doing something next.
So because tedious podcasters can speculate about it until they actually announce it.
And we fell for it.
One interesting thing about it, though, is, because we also suggested, I think, that maybe it might be the Maisels Brothers footage from the first US tour that might be being untouched up. And actually, one thing I wonder is that Get Back, having done so well with a contemporary audience, it does that audience probably want more of like hip late Beatles? Would they be quite so keen on like early Beatles, which is incredibly hip as far as I'm concerned, but it's maybe a bit more of a harder sell because of that image of just like, oh, they were a bit more lightweight and they were just lovable mop tops at the time, you know.
Yes, I do know what you mean. I like the idea. Everyone can relax now because early Beatles is hip as far as Ed is concerned.
Yep. You heard it here first.
Ed's the arbiter of what is hip or not. No, I agree. That's a thing that I think about quite often, to be honest with you, because I think it's reflective in the anniversary reissues as well. You know, yeah. I think as much as I think Beatles fans are clamoring for this technology to be able to separate out the individual tracks of their early recordings, so that we can get decent remixes and stereo mixes and those kind of things. But in the back of my mind, I'm like, does that appeal to anyone outside of hardcore Beatles fans? Whereas the re-releases of Abbey Road and Let It Be album, and those, I think there is a, they still have a contemporary feel, so I can understand why commercially they might make more sense.
Mm.
So I don't know, I've always kind of had it in the back of my mind that I think they would be more likely to focus much more on the later stages of the career than anything early.
Yeah, true. Because actually, when they do those remixes, it's not just for sort of like older fans like us, I suppose. It's also to kind of try and re-engage that younger audience.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so, like, one of the things that's posited a lot is Apple owns the Star Club tapes now, so maybe they're going to use that technology to separate that out and really clean up the audio. And I'd love to hear that.
Yeah.
People in their 20s particularly want to hear lots of 50s rock and roll covers, which is what it is. I don't think there's a single Lennon McCartney song in that set list.
Yeah.
Well, there's maybe one at the end or something, but basically it is all rock and roll covers. And actually do the younger audience they're trying to keep engaged, do they want to hear it that much? I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, completely agree. And also just in terms of like as an image thing as well, I think... You know, we've talked quite a lot about how since Get Back came out, I think Paul McCartney has enjoyed a sort of reappraisal and a resurgence in his career since then. I think you'd probably want to keep that going, right? Or at least he would probably want to keep going, this image of them being vanguards of what came after rock and roll music at that time, as opposed to going back to the rockabilly stuff. I think you're right. The footage that's used is cleaned up really, really well. I was quite taken aback sometimes about how surprisingly cinematic some of that early footage looked. They've really like boldened the colours and it looks glossy, even though it was presumably filmed on a home camera. At that time. This is 68, right, Rishikesh?
And for the fact that it's being filmed at all. Fun fact, we actually have Ringo to thank for that.
Oh, really?
Ringo and Maureen went home after, I think, about 10 days.
Apparently, yeah.
And apparently the first thing they did when they got home was they parceled up a load of film to send out to them so they could all carry on filming each other.
Oh, really?
So I think maybe they were running out of film and they couldn't get access to it.
I did not know that. That's really good.
So, yeah.
That's actually a really interesting fact, and I would have appreciated hearing that in the film instead of hearing yet again about how Ringo took an entire suitcase full of Heinz baked beans with him. Because I think that is included in every single Beatles documentary I've seen.
I love it. It's a great fact, though, isn't it?
It is. But it's also one of those ones that I'm waiting for it to be debunked. You know, because it can't, I just feel like this is one of those things that has just kind of been exaggerated over time. Yeah. And surely he didn't just do that. But we've just watched a film that has Mark Lewisohn on as a talking head. Like, if that fact was not true, that would be the time to debunk it. But no, apparently he did do that.
You think, well, maybe he's not got that far in his research. Maybe book three, the big revelation is going to be it was actually spaghetti hoops. We've been fed a lie this whole time.
The reason he hasn't got around to it yet is because he's looking into it now, but he's still stuck in the early stages of how Heinz were formed. Like, that's that's going to take a few months.
Yeah.
Good. No, okay. That's really interesting to know. Well done, Ringo. Here I am thinking that Ringo's contribution to this whole period was actually sorely lacking because he only stayed there for 10 days. But actually, no, arguably he's made the most important contribution of all.
Yeah.
By
yeah.
just helping us see documentation of it.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, yeah, so the footage looks amazing considering it was shot presumably on someone's home camera using Ringo's film. Now that I know that, thank you. But it's incredible considering it looks really modernized in a similar way to, I think, Get Back does. Considering it was shot on a home camera in, when is it, 1968?
Yeah.
Was that 1968? So what was happening around that time? When did it go? Because it doesn't actually go into that in an awful lot of detail. So
no.
It's obviously the film explores the relationship between the Beatles and India, but doesn't do that whole thing of here's what the Beatles were doing when they decided to make that trip.
Yeah. So it does document their various trips to India, and there are sort of. And it does that in a sort of broadly chronological way. So the first time they're talking about is 6th of July, 1966. It says here, I don't have that date in my head. So the entire group visit Delhi. And there's a nice account by Karim Bedi, the actor who went on to play the big henchman in Octopussy. So he's a talking head, and he's talking about how he wanted to meet them, or he wanted to go and interview them. And he says that he sort of found out which hotel they were going to be in, went and sat in the lobby and waited for Brian Epstein. And he talks about, like, when he finally saw Brian Epstein, he said, I'm here to do a radio interview for the government. I'm not completely clear whether he was making that up as an excuse to meet them or not. But he says Brian was like quite annoyed with him. And when you realize the context, this is the day after the Manila incident, when they've just been thrown out of Manila, chased out of Manila and almost killed.
Right. Okay, that makes sense.
I think that was 5th of July, and then they've flown to Bangkok for refueling, not really spent any time there, then straight on to Delhi. So they've got a scheduled 3-day break in Delhi.
Right.
So like they're not playing a gig there. They don't have any public engagements there. It is literally just a holiday. So, which is interesting, because it must be that they have decided they fancy it.
Like
we've got 3 days, what can we do? Let's
go to Delhi.
Let's do that. You know, I'm interested in seeing that place. So you can imagine, like, by that point, obviously George is interested in going there, you know. And then sort of later on, so it's only a couple of months later after they finished touring. In September to October, George and Patty go to Bombay, and that's mainly so that George can study sitar with Ravi Shankar.
And that's explored a lot in the film, obviously, right? Relationship and how that starts. And that's interesting as well, because that's also framed as a holiday. That's something that he has chosen to do because he wants to do it. So he's obviously completely enamoured of the country at that point.
And the music, certainly. Because I think he's met Ravi Shankar by this point. Through sort of Indian musicians in London, he's got to meet Ravi Shankar, and I think he's certainly done enough to convince Ravi Shankar of his passion for this instrument. Because there will have been lots of people who had just picked up a sitar in the 60s and sort of banged out a riff, and then
smoke on water,
but he's serious about it. Now, I mean, the sitar is, like Ravi Shankar says a lot in this and other. Films. It is an instrument that takes lots and lots of practice. It takes a lifetime of practice, and you need to be properly devoted to it, you know. And so you see George, there's footage of him and Ravi Shankar sitting in a field or sort of by a cliffside, it seems like, practicing sitar together, and George is just doing scales. And that's really interesting because, you know, George was always a guitarist who wanted to get things right and was quite painstaking about it. Like, by his own admission, he wasn't like a great improviser on the guitar.
Yeah.
He spent a long time working out a guitar solo to get it just right and then play it, you know, which I'm sure as their career went on and they had more studio time, he had a bit more time to do that kind of thing, which actually is what makes some of his guitar work early on in their career sort of all the more remarkable.
Mm.
If you think about that guitar arrangement for Till There Was You, which is entirely theirs. If you listen to the original Till There Was You from The Music Man, it's none of that guitar is in there. That's all them.
Yeah. You know?
And yeah, and so like having figured out that solo and that arrangement is really remarkable for people their age, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, we talked about Till There Was Youth because that was obviously a favorite of mine.
Yeah,
I love that arrangement. I think that is it George who did the arrangement, or is it Paul who did the arrangement of the guitar?
I'm not sure, but I think it was a bit of both.
But George would have done the solo either way, right?
I think so.
But yeah, no, I completely agree. I think one of the I'm taking you off your timeline topic, but I think talking about, obviously there's a lot of focus in this film on George, understandably.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that I found really compelling about the whole story is this impression you get that George is just really drawn, like inexplicably drawn to Indian music and obviously the spiritualism that he eventually discovers while there. And it just kind of, I don't know, I think it made me feel like it adds a little bit more to this idea of the spirituality of the film when you have someone who is mysteriously drawn to it in a way that I don't think anybody was able to explain.
Yeah.
This kindredship that he felt with Ravi Shankar and this passion that he developed very quickly for this music, in a way that you kind of feel like, you know, without wanting to get too sort of poetic about it, you kind of can imagine that it's sort of some sort of higher power or, some, it's almost like fate pulling the strings or something like that. Just because that's how it's sort of framed, and not just in the film, but just because there is no other explanation. You know, it seems very strange that he was just very, very suddenly taken with this movement. And culture, and I think that sort of lends a lot of weight in this film as they then go on to talk about the their time with the Maharishi and what that meant to them spiritually.
It's nice, you know, it's really nice to hear that, I think. And also, you know, so someone in the film who was there at the time or knew Maharishi, I think, and she says that Maharishi said about George, like, this guy is on his last life.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
you know, he's and that's the reason why all this stuff, he's kind of attuned to this stuff and it makes sense to him. So as soon as he talks about the first time he heard in Indian music, it just felt very familiar to him. You know, and so yeah, I think there's this idea of like all these lives that they've all gone through, George is on his last one, which is a lovely idea, you know. But yeah, it's funny. Was it him or someone else in the film who talks about Ringo? Is Ringo meditated by feeling and heart?
Yes, that's right. Yes,
with the other Beatles, there was too much brain in the way.
That's right. Yeah.
I thought, oh, thanks. is that good? Or, but it was nice to sort of get the idea of like their different approaches to meditation. Because I don't know if you've ever tried meditation. You know, I have. Not very seriously, you know, and it's quite hard to do the thing that they describe, which is to literally turn off your mind, relax and float downstream. This thing of blocking out conscious thought and just replacing it with the mantra. And it's difficult. It takes effort and it can be quite frustrating. Mm. And I can imagine that John would have been the kind of guy who just got annoyed with it, you know.
Yeah,
but actually, he seems to have committed to it quite well for those 6 weeks or so, you know.
I mean, that is something that I wanted to come on to, and it's worth talking about now, but I was quite surprised that the, you know, we've been talking about the film with praise up until now, but I think there are some things that I think where the movie misses a trick a little bit, or at least I was surprised by it. So one of those things is the film almost suggests that when the Beatles left Rishikesh under a bit of a cloud because of how their relationship with the Maharishi soured, that kind of severed their ties to any of those teachings. I was surprised by that because I think it does a good job of showing us later on that George in particular, it said that he felt guilty about how they handled the end of that friendship with Maharishi, and he then in later life went back and apologized and cleared the air. And it also goes on to say that Paul, or there's a bit of an interview with Paul where he says that he took his two kids to go and see Maharishi as well. But what it doesn't do is go on to show us or tell us that John and Paul went on to exhibit some of these teachings in their career later on. Like, I'm surprised there was no through line made between the spiritualism that they were exploring in Rishikesh and John's peace activism, because it feels like those kind of are connected in a way, and obviously are only separated by, a year.
Yeah, if that, I suppose. I mean, they get back and he writes Revolution over there, or he either writes in Rishikesh or around those times. I mean, it's on the Isha demos anyway.
Yep.
And so that is probably his first proper big peace statement.
Yeah, that's true.
Or political statement. So yeah, there does seem to be a through line between those two things. But it's interesting how it's not a connection that people naturally draw. It's not a connection that I naturally draw, because of this tendency to think of, they had this period where they were hippies, 1967, then they went to India, and then when they got back, they were just like guitars, bass and drums again. And not that all that stuff was forgotten, but it's tempting just to kind of like segment the Beatles' career.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I think that's, we tend to think of it as a sort of timeline in these separate segments.
Yeah, and I think that, in my mind at least, one of the things that throws that into confusion at least a little bit for me is, it's like you say, it would be easy to compartmentalize this whole thing. And they went to Rishikesh where they, you could say they were given sort of a spiritual outlook on life, and then when they came back, John would start with this sort of line in peace activism. But before they went to Rishikesh, they'd done All You Need Is Love, which you could argue is in the same vein.
Yeah, yeah.
So I guess there was always sort of a little bit of that thinking
involved.
But I don't know, I just would have expected a little bit more of a continuation or an argument made that actually it helped inform those later stages in their career. And probably the big one for me is, as you were just talking about it then, I'm pretty sure Paul McCartney still meditates. And John did as well, right up until his death. Right, so it's because I think what I forget what her name is now, but I think she her byline came up as the author of The Maharishi and Me.
Mm-hmm.
And she made the point in the film that when the band left India, when they stopped meditating, they would stop. The argument, I guess, that she's making is that when they stopped meditating, they would no longer have harmony amongst themselves, and that would directly lead to the band splitting up.
Yeah.
And the film almost argues that that's what happened, completely missing out any of the stuff that happened between White Album and it's a sort of I found it a bit of a lazy argument to make, and not that the film's making that argument, but it was presented in the film.
Yeah, it's framing, isn't it? I suppose.
Yeah,
it's, we've sort of spoken before about documentaries that we'll take sort of one element of the Beatles' career, and then, but because of that focus, we'll then frame it as if that was the only thing that happened, or as if everything was leading up to this, or everything was leading up to the next thing. What was the thing at the end of the Sgt. Pepper documentary? It said within a year the Beatles would release the White Album.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Oh, is that what
is that what it's building up to?
It's odd framing. But I suppose it's focus on one thing is its big strength.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I suppose that probably leads to that sort of framing.
It makes sense and I was wondering this, and I think this is also a problem that we often talk about with these documentaries, is where do you end it?
Yeah.
And I think what in this documentary, they can't just have them on the plane back to London.
Yeah.
And that's it. So there's a little bit of what happened next. And by framing it in this way, you are left with this argument being made that actually in some way them leaving in discord ultimately contributed to their breakup without a hint of an Alan Klein in the picture at all.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can see why that's a bad thing. But in my mind, the way to end this would have been to talk about the ongoing influence beyond the Beatles.
Yeah.
After the Beatles split up, like if anything survived after they separated, it's actually some of the things that they took from their experience in Rishikesh and continue to do in personally.
Yeah.
That feels like a stronger case to make. Here I am doing that thing of, if I would have made this film, this is how I would have done it.
Yeah.
Which is always a clever stance to take.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
As we've just been talking about Hrishikesh and Maharishi, how do you think the film handled the story of the Maharishi and how that relationship soured? Because I must admit, I think before watching this film, I was a little bit uncertain about what to believe with that whole area.
So I think the stance it takes is sort of fairly balanced. So there's interesting information in there, which I had heard somewhere before, but not, I can't remember where, which is that part of the problem with the relationship was a film crew came out. Maharishi had done a deal with a film crew to come and film. And they were all sort of, you know, in the ashram, and the Beatles were going, but we're here to meditate. Why are these people here like this getting in the way, you know? And like, you know, this isn't what we signed up for. So I think Mark Lewisohn is a talking head in the documentary, and I think he says at one point that they were always very conscious of not being exploited, of kind of people making money off the back of them, and they didn't like it. So, you know, this thing that they've done to like go off and meditate and try and find some inner peace, and here's this guy bringing a camera crew along. So that was a detail that isn't talked about very often. And also the thing that Paul and George had just before they went to Hrishikesh, I think, flown out to see Maharishi in Sweden, because he'd been saying all this stuff about, there's going to be a TV show, I'm making a TV show with the Beatles, and they were like, oh, well, we haven't heard of it.
I love that interview footage where George is like, we've just come out here to have a little chat. to an interviewer who has no idea of the context of what he's talking about, but it's just really interesting that George couldn't help himself to say that that's why they're there.
Yeah. I love the euphemism, like, as if they've come out here to beat him up.
Yeah. You know?
Like, they're going to go around the back and just, like, kick the shit out of him. And then get the plane back to London, you know. It's a fun mental image, you know? but there's that, and there's also like the much more well-known story about there being rumors that Maharishi was being inappropriate with some of the young women at the ashram, and so there's a couple of accounts of this, you know, which kind of seems to be corroborated. However, when Magic Alex is introduced, they do the old dark foreboding music as soon as you see him.
Yeah.
So you kind of know which way that their bread's buttered as far as Magic Alex is concerned. And so, yes, he is very much framed as he deliberately went there to try and wrestle John out of the Maharishi's clutches by manipulating him, because he wanted to be his new guru. So, it is taking that stance, but it is also just introducing some detail about it that isn't often talked about.
Which I did find really interesting. I think on the whole, that was quite balanced, because I think my impression of that was that the Maharishi just didn't really know. You can imagine a world, not that the film explicitly says this, but you can imagine a world in which he's quite naive in these things, and actually he's being strong-armed into these business deals. Where a film crew are turning up, because I can imagine that there were sort of greedy corporate types taking advantage.
Yeah,
I think.
But perhaps I think there's an interview there where he says, you know, I don't, Yeah, I don't really know anything about money. Obviously, I need money in order to keep this thing going, but I don't particularly deal with it. There's another thing where at Bangor, when the Beatles have gone up to see him there, and there's a and he's being interviewed outside, and they're saying, "What do you think about the Beatles?" He says, "You know, they're nice young men, very switched on. Yeah. What do you think of their music? I haven't heard their music, but I'm sure it must be very good if they're as popular as they are." That kind of thing. So that I found quite interesting. It's interesting to kind of think of people who are just sort of so spiritually enlightened that. Yeah. That they don't, that they've never heard pop music.
Yeah.
But also, it's the 1960s. This guy has not been like sitting in a cave in India the whole time.
Yes, yeah.
He is very much in the West.
Yeah.
He's staying in hotels in the West. He's staying in cities and giving speeches and things like that. I find it quite hard to believe that he had never heard the Beatles.
It stood out to me as well for the exact same reason. Yeah. At that point, I feel like you are more savvy. Yes. Letting on, it feels like you're happily sort of co-opting this persona.
Yeah.
not to say that it's for any malicious intent at all, but yeah, I thought the same.
Of course, I mean, it's such a missed opportunity for like the greatest reaction video of all time. Like Maharishi hears the Beatles music for the first time, and you see his facial expression.
This is really fresh.
Yeah, I mean, that would go viral on YouTube straight away.
You mentioned before about how the film frames like Magic Alex. One of my favourite things that the film does is, so at some point in the film, it introduces this footage of John Lennon playing guitar and he's kind of gurning to camera a bit.
Mm.
And when gurning to the camera, he kind of adopts a bit of a sinister looking face deliberately.
Yes. Yeah.
And then the film plays that exact same footage again about 10 minutes later, really zoomed in on John Lennon's eyes when they start talking about the Maharishi sex allegations. And it's really like, well, before it was jovial. You can't now use the same footage again to make it, as in like John knew and that's, you know.
Right, yeah. I didn't notice that, but you're right. That is sort of cheating, isn't it?
It is a bit, yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, about that question, like, was Maharishi using them for publicity? Yeah, I mean, he certainly got very good publicity out of it. In fact, I was thinking about it, like, this is the greatest sort of like brand endorsement that anyone, celebrity endorsement anyone's ever got. Because we're talking about this guy like 55 years later.
Yeah.
And most people in his position, absolutely nobody would have heard of, you know?
Like, yeah, absolutely.
Because by the way, there's loads and loads of equivalent gurus. Well, obviously loads in India, but I mean, in terms of ones who came to the West.
Yeah,
you know, and we'll sort of, but you can see if you're in like any UK city, you can find a flyer like most weekends where there's the function room of a hotel where a guru has come and he's like doing a talk and a few people would turn up. You know, Maharishi was that guy, and other than his association with the Beatles, there's no way we would have heard of him. You know,
yeah.
So I mean, I'm sort of less interested in the question of whether he was deliberately using them for publicity, because I can see both sides of that. But actually, I just think it's fascinating like how successful that was.
You know? Yeah, I think it's fascinating as well. But I think there's no question about whether or not he was using the Beatles for publicity.
Yeah.
I think the reason why there's a debate about it is there's no easy answers to the question, was that okay?
Mm.
Because actually, why shouldn't he? And also, especially when, by his own reasoning, the publicity he's getting is just to spread his message further, which is one of peace and love.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, it's not like I'm using the Beatles for publicity so I can get people to send me checks.
I mean, but that was the result of it, though. I mean,
was it?
I mean, like, financially, he did amazingly well out of it.
Did he? Okay, well, I guess that's context that's missing from the film then.
Well,
right?
Yeah, I suppose so. You know, and I think, you know, and the guys stayed in, like, nice hotels and stuff.
Yeah,
like,
there's a bit of that, sure.
It's not, but, I mean, you know, I don't begrudge him that at all. No. But, you know, I think it is important to put it in context of, like, yes, he spreading a genuine, you know, I think sincere and positive message of peace and love.
Yeah.
But, you know, but he was doing all right out of it as well. But, you know, at the end of the day, there's nothing wrong with that, really.
No, not at all. No, I think one of the other things about that whole section that I found really interesting was, and I'm always struck by this differentiation between John and Paul, even back then in the early days, which is that when there's a footage of them being interviewed about the whole Rishikesh experience, and John outright says, "We made a mistake.
Yes.
We absolutely made a mistake."
Yeah.
And you can just tell that, like, there's this sort of simmering, almost resentment. It's not like regret. It's like there's a sort of a flash of anger, I think, with him, as there often is with these kind of things. But Paul is so much more diplomatic when he talks about it. He says, we put him on a pedestal. Like, as in, he's saying, we thought he was someone else, but at the end of the day, he's just human. Because of course he was, but we thought he was something else.
Yeah.
And it almost frames it as in a, actually, we were partly to blame as well. And it's just really interesting, the different approaches to that question. Like, Paul has always been a bit more diplomatic in that way, I find.
Yeah, it's sort of, well, it's certainly always more diplomatic, but I think also it's quite unusual for him to sort of publicly admit any vulnerability, actually, like on behalf of him or the band, because it's not something he really does. Even in the lyrics to his songs have very little vulnerability in them.
Yeah.
You know, I can think of a handful from his solo career, you know, but if you think of a song like For No One, which is about the breakup of a relationship, but is sung in the second person, not the first person, you know, so it's not him saying my girlfriend has left me.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, so he is showing a bit of vulnerability there. He is kind of saying, you know, he's saying we made a mistake, but in a slightly different way, you know?
Yeah.
But he's not saying like it was our fault in quite the same way.
But I just, one of the things that, again, maybe I don't know if this is territory the film necessarily should have explored, but I'm always left unsure about how much this was seen as like a massive blunder.
Yeah.
Like how much does it mean, like, knowing what happened, or, you know, knowing, I guess, the events that unfolded that led them to leave Rishikesh, it feels to me like it's actually, they're at risk of being quite embarrassed about the whole thing. Something that was so obviously clearly in the public eye.
Yeah.
You know, they've gone to India. Maharishi has become this sort of public figure. The very idea that these four lads have gone to India and discovered spiritualism and are now meditating and stuff, you can understand how potentially, maybe it's in more in this day and age than back then, but it would be something that newspapers would be ridiculing them for.
Yeah.
And then for them to come back with a degree of tail between their legs, you know, because they're saying it's a mistake now. Like, I wonder how that was perceived at the time in the press.
Yeah, I think, so again, a bit of context. This is roughly a month after Magical Mystery Tour film comes out.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Critically, I think probably what's happening here is that they're sort of at that point where they've had their first big knock critically. And now when they're in the papers, I think it's maybe for all the wrong reasons, you know.
Yeah, sure.
So people are kind of finding ways to knock them down. So, I mean, in 68, you've got sort of John and Yoko becoming a thing for the first time. And, you know, and so like, those two are being ridiculed. They're taking advantage of that ridicule to spread a message of peace, much to their credit. And what else is happening? Is it George's drug bust, maybe in 68, I think? I could be wrong. These things are happening, and they're sort of, I think the papers in general are now saying, you know, as Ringo says in Anthology, when talking about the reaction to Magical Mystery Tour, you know, this is their chance now to say, you know, they've gone too far. Who do they think they are?
Yeah.
And so I think there is a bit more of a, they're getting a bit more of a sort of critical kicking, you know.
That's fair enough and interesting. I think, and also just a quick note to say that if anyone's listening to this and is interested to hear more about the significant cultural failure that is seen to be Magical Mystery Tour, you can go back and listen to another episode that we discussed, a two-parter on the whole film and its reaction. There we go, I've done my bit of selling.
There's a plug for you.
Yeah, there you go. Should really do that more. One of the things that I thought was quite interesting about the film was it seems like only recently we were discussing the film Wonderwall, and George Harrison's obvious contribution to that film was a heavily Indian-inspired soundtrack. And I think in that episode, we mentioned that after that point, it didn't seem as though George went on to release any more music that was so obviously inspired by Indian music.
Yeah.
So it felt like it was a phase, and that phase was completed when he produced the entire soundtrack for the film Wonderwall in that style. And I think we talked about that in the episode about how that, you know, that felt like maybe he'd run that course dry a little bit, or, you know, he'd not exhausted, but at least was satisfied with his need to sort of explore Indian music in his own output.
Yeah.
But one of the things that this film does is go on to show us how he continued to enjoy that music, and obviously his relationship with Ravi Shankar. And so I wonder, like, at what point did he decide to not explore that in his own music as much?
Yeah, I wonder too. I mean, because I was looking at him and Ravi Shankar practicing together on a hilltop.
Yes,
you know, and Ravi Shankar always said that, you know, George was a very good student. You know, he took this thing very seriously. He wasn't just there to sort of muck about for a bit. But at the same time, we, in terms of George's out musical, like, recorded output that has sitar on it, post 68, there's not really anything. Oh, the Inner Light, maybe, does that come out in 69? I forget. But anyway, around that time, 68, 69,
yeah.
There isn't really any more sitar, like him playing the sitar on a record, I don't think. Or at the very least, there's very little. And so he has gone back to guitar, and it's around that time he sort of develops that signature slide guitar sound that everyone kind of knows him for. And I wonder whether maybe that kind of made him fall back in love with the guitar a bit more. I'm not sure. And the interesting thing is, he and Ravi Shankar, like, remained friends, you know, very good friends right up until George's death. Yeah. And you can see interviews with them both sort of later on in life in this film. But the interesting thing is, presumed there was a point at which George said, no more sitar lessons, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Mm.
And I wonder how Ravi felt about that. You know, I wonder whether there was any disappointment of, because I genuinely don't think George approached this in a casual way. His sort of spiritual commitment was lifelong and genuine and profound. But the actual playing of the sitar, I don't know, maybe he did it, you know, just more in his spare time.
And that's what I wondered as well, because you also get this impression from some of the other talking heads in the know that it was mutual between George and Ravi Shankar, right? And the impression you get from everyone talking about this relationship was that George was almost like a star pupil, the person who was willing to put in the time and dedicate himself to its instrument in the way that Ravi Shankar felt was absolutely necessary in order to do it well. So it does seem unlikely that George would get to a point where he's like, actually, no, you know what, I'm done.
Yeah.
You know, I've learned the scales, I'm fine. I've got C, I've got D, I've got most of E, that's fine, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I can play the riff to Sunshine of Your Love now. I'm fine, yeah.
That's all I wanted to know.
But I think there's a wider point about, like, the use of the music in the film, actually. It made me think of the fact that when we talk about documentaries, we often talk a lot about whether or not they have the rights to use the music and how that tends to be a bit of a sink or swim thing for documentaries. And I think probably this is the first one we've seen and talked about together that doesn't have the rights to use Beatles music, contains no Beatles music, and doesn't suffer from it.
Didn't even occur to me while I was watching it. At no point when I was watching that film did I, which is normally always so apparent.
Right.
And I'd even go so far as to say, you know, a good example is the Sgt. Pepper's documentary we covered on an earlier episode, where it's obviously they're talking about specific songs. So you're very conscious of the fact that they're talking about songs that you're not currently hearing because they don't have the rights to play those songs.
Mm.
And I'd go so far as to say that they do the exact same thing in this documentary. They're talking about they call out specific songs like Sexy Sadie.
Dear Prudence,
exactly. And at no point did it occur to me, this would be a really good time to actually play some of this music.
Yeah.
And it's just not, because obviously it doesn't have the rights. Like, it just, I can't even put my finger on how it gets away with that so well.
Yeah.
But yeah, it just didn't occur to me. It's very, very well handled, I think.
Yeah. And I wonder if the answer lies in what we were talking about, where its focus is as much on India as it is on the Beatles. And that perhaps, because you're not expecting, or maybe we're expecting, but like once the documentary has started and you realize what it's doing, you're not expecting any kind of dissection of the songs on the White Album or anything, you know, because 50 years ago today, the Sgt. Pepper documentary we were talking about does do that. It is a documentary about a specific album which contains none of the songs, and that's a really difficult thing to get around. This is not about an album. So yeah, I think it's framing, isn't it? I suppose
it is. Yeah,
it's
framed
in a slightly different
way. I think you're right. I think it's the it's what we talked about right at the start of this, which was that it doesn't feel like a documentary about the Beatles necessarily. It's definitely much more exploring the context of them. So I guess the absence of that music is so much less apparent.
Yeah,
than it is in other documentaries.
Yeah, it was nice to see. So there is a lot of sort of Indian inspired music in the score.
Yeah,
it's really nice to see that again, like that Sgt. Pepper documentary. A lot of that music was written by Andre Barrow, who was George in the Bootleg Beatles for several years.
That's brilliant.
Yeah,
that'd be brilliant. Like he's got one thing he's really good at,
right?
And he's really managed to make it work for himself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Being brilliant. George.
Yeah, it's such a brilliant niche to exploit.
Yes, exactly.
Isn't it? You know? And but he's also sort of involved in the one really odd. I'll call it a misstep because it kind of is. It's the one bit in the documentary that's quite incongruous because right at the start there is some sort of wartime footage of Liverpool. And a sort of heavy Scouse accent voiceover comes on. You don't see who it is. And it talks about growing up in Arnold Grove. And you think, oh, is this George? Is this supposed to be George? Is this an actor voicing George from his autobiography or something like that? And then it talks about, oh, you could always hear the Indian music coming from the Harrison household because George's mother, Louise, really liked it. And you realise that this is... So you think, oh... Is this a neighbor? Is this what's happening? And then it's never really explained, and they don't really say who that is. And then that is the only example in the whole documentary of any kind of reconstruction or someone playing a character.
Yeah.
And then at the end, Andre Barrow is quoted as Arnold Grove resident or Arnold Grove neighbor or something.
Yeah.
So that's his voice doing it.
Yeah, it's odd, isn't it?
It's very odd.
It's an odd thing to do and not keep up that conceit at any other point in the film.
Yeah. And also, it just... So I suppose it must be that they feel like that information is key, which it is. It's very interesting, the idea that George's mother listened to Indian music, which she would find on the radio when she was pregnant with George. You know, that's a nice detail, and you know, and quite possibly a significant detail as well. And so maybe all they've got is a transcript of a written interview with one of their neighbours who said this, and they have no audio or video source to use for it. So all they can do... But there must be another way to do it.
The other way to do it would be to present that information to one of their talking heads and ask them to voice it on camera.
Yeah, to talk about it on
camera.
Yeah, that would make sense.
And actually, you know, arguably the best person to do that would be Mark Lewisohn, right?
Yeah.
Right? As in, like, here is the kind of detail that often gets missed, but he is famous for.
Yeah.
And just saying that we know from this newspaper or whatever the source material is, that this neighbour had said that they would always hear this music from Harrison House. And it just, that feels like so much more in keeping with the rest of the film as opposed to this weird, like you say, reconstruction.
Yeah, but he would have been like, how many sources do you have for this?
Exactly, 100%, like, yeah. You know. Which is why you then give it to someone else. Right, absolutely, anybody else.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, some of the talking heads on the film are tenuous. There's the guy that is on there playing a guitar, whose only role, I think, is... his only like reason for being in the film is because he used to take car trips in India.
Yeah.
And he's talking about, I guess, the sort of a trend for how more people started doing that once the Beatles went to India.
Yeah.
The way he talks about his involvement and his only reason for being in the film was that basically he's someone who took a lot of car journeys out there. It's like his byline might as well have read bum. You know, like,
I think his byline actually does say sort of like musician and like hippie historian or something.
Well,
like that,
it's like traveling, I don't know, traveling car trip man or something. No
yes.
idea. Anyway, so clearly a detail that I didn't pick up on. Anyway, you could have got that guy to read the information out about the neighbor hearing because he would have done it.
Yeah, I think he would have done it. You're right. Yeah.
The other thing I was really pleased about actually in the documentary, because it is a point that we had made before, is the documentary does call out, and it's actually around that same time or the same subject matter, where they go into detail about why when we think about the psychedelic movement now and drug culture in the 60s, that is normally accompanied with sitar music.
Yeah.
And I think that's because we've made the point on a previous episode before. I think there's even footage of George explaining why that might be, about how there were hippies doing drugs. And it just right, so happens right. to be that, you know, the hippies who might actually be playing that music are, it just so happens, were the type of people who would also do drugs.
Yeah.
And then you've got that footage of Ravi Shankar saying, I like my music to be able to get people high. So when they're already high to begin with,
yeah,
it's nice.
Yeah, so there's footage from a Dick Cavett interview with George and Ravi Shankar.
Right.
And Dick Cavett is sort of making that link.
Oh, bizarre music.
Yeah.
That's bad, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And George kind of, you can see his grimace as he sort of laughs that off, you know. But yeah, he probably had to put up with a bit of that, I suppose.
Absolutely.
If you're going on the chat show circuit, you know. But he sort of Dick Cavett is making that link between drugs and Indian music. And yeah, it really made me think about, as we've said, so in any documentary where you're going to talk about 1967 and LSD and all that stuff, inevitably sitar on the soundtrack, you know, because we just associate the two things. It is, you know, the sound of LSD, the soundtrack of LSD, weirdly. Yeah. But ironically, the Beatles sort of renounced drugs in order to start transcendental meditation because they were convinced of the merits of transcendental meditation. I mean, they very much went back to drugs after it. Don't get me wrong. But I think for the time, and also this culture of that goes along with the music, the spiritualism, and it is the idea behind the music is that it gets you closer to God.
This set
is,
your mind free, and
this is the idea, and even just sort of smoking weed doesn't really go along with that. The idea is to be clear headed, and to achieve a state of enlightenment through the music and through the meditation. Mm. So it's interesting that the two things even now are sort of so closely associated, I guess.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, you're right. Cleanliness, in terms of cleanliness of spirit and cleanliness of mind, is so important to that philosophy.
Yeah.
But I guess drug usage is almost like a designed to be a bit of a cheat way to achieve the same similar experience.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's directly opposite in terms of how you get there, but I can understand why they're linked, because I guess both are trying to supposedly achieve the same goal.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. It does feel unfortunate that the two are now intrinsically linked as they are.
Yeah. It's funny how, there seems to have been this thing in the 60s where a lot of people... society had shifted so much from, you know, that sort of baby boomer generation... who sort of had more sort of freedom to have creative jobs for the first time. And as teenagers, they'd had disposable income for the first time. So they were developing into very different people from their parents' generation. And a lot of them were looking for some kind of higher truth for the first, you know, in a way that didn't necessarily involve the Church of England or, you know, or the Baptist Church in America or whatever it is. You know, Western religion, you know, they were sort of looking to the East for these things, and they were looking to drugs for these things. And I think a lot of people, John is a fantastic example of this. A lot of people just tried a lot of things and none of them quite did the trick.
Yeah.
You know, if you watch Mad Men, there's a few characters in that who are a bit like that. They spend their time in the 60s sort of looking for the answer and not quite finding it, and trying drugs and trying meditation, you know. And so it's interesting that now some of these things were, as you say, that, you know, the drugs thing was a bit of a sort of fast track to enlightenment, if you like, without having to do the work kind of thing. But yeah, so it's funny that these things are now kind of like grouped together. It's just sort of a general psychedelic era.
Yeah.
You know, there was drugs and there was like Indian meditation and all that kind of stuff. As if it, you know, the meditation thing was just a fad and as if it hadn't been around for thousands of years before, you know.
Yeah. Talking of meditation being around for thousands of years before, I think to bring this discussion, this episode to a close, I think overall that is the strongest thing that the film achieves is, as we said before, not just exploring what the Beatles were doing in India, but actually the impact and effect that India had on the Beatles. And I think the film ends in a really quite nice way in you have a couple of really nice talking heads talking about how much it means to them that India has a legacy in that way. And, you know, not just in the songs that were written there that appeared on the White Album, but I guess how by the Beatles going to India, there was a bit of a bridging between the two, you know, Western and Indian cultures that still exists today as a result of that whole time period. And there's a really nice line that I picked up on right towards the end of the film where sort of a young female songwriter says that it's like a gift that India gave the world through the Beatles.
Yeah.
And I just thought that was a really nice way of putting it. And I feel like if the film is about anything, instead of just being about what the Beatles did in India, it's about that. It's about the relationship between the two of them and actually the long-lasting effect that had, that we still see the effects of now today. So
yeah.
I think it's very, very powerful, actually, in that way, and very effective in making that argument.
Yeah, I agree. And I think actually one of the ways in which it sort of lends power to that argument is that there are far more Indian contributors to this film than there are Western contributors to it. If you think about that, so there's a couple of authors, Mark Lewison, there's Steve Turner, Patty Boyd is there in sort of voiceover. She's recorded audio. It's not loads of other Western contributors. Most of them are Indian. Like this is, yeah. This is giving their perspective. And I think it's showing a really important perspective and like a really new and a really fascinating one. And I liked it a lot for that.
And hopefully you agree, if you're listening to this and you've seen the film, hopefully you think the same about it as we do. But if not, or if so, please get in touch and let us know. You can reach us on all the usual social media platforms at Beatles Films Pod. While you're at it, while you're online, why not quickly find us and leave us a review? We're always grateful for any positive, of course, reviews. They really go a long way in helping us promote this podcast. So we'd appreciate that. Thank you very much. Otherwise, we will see you again for another episode next week. Thank you for listening and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.